Hi, I'm Lydia Bastianich, and you're listening to Food Fridays on the Leonard Lopate Show.
I'm sure we've all had one of those moments when we take a bite of food and it magically becomes so much more. We'll remember that meal for the rest of our lives. James Oslin, the editor-in-chief of Savura magazine, has assembled a book's worth full of such moments. It's called A Fork in the Road, and it includes contributions from the likes of Michael Pollan, Marcus Samuelson, and Luisa Emilino, the reviews director of Publishers Weekly, who wrote the entry Fish Heads, and Alan Rickman, a longtime food writer and winner of 15 James Beard Journalism Awards, who wrote Omar Sharif Slept Here. The book is published by Lonely Planet, and I'm very glad that it brings Luisa, Alan, and James to our show today. Welcome.
Nice to see you.
Thanks
nice
for having us.
And to my listeners, while you're listening and salivating during the segment, we invite you to share your own food epiphanies with us. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Shoot us a tweet at Leonard Lopate. Write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or find us on Facebook. So I'm going to throw this out to all of you. You know it when it happens, but how would you define one of those epiphanies? Let's begin with you, Luisa.
Well, it's when something special is happening. I mean, there's ritual foods that you have on certain holidays. They're always very important. But then you go somewhere and there's something totally unfamiliar that kind of knocks you right off your feet. I remember my first taste of mango, which was very exciting. I mean, in New York now you can get anything, but back in the days, I mean, I had never seen a mango. And they were...
I never even learned how to dance it.
I was on a ship, and you were supposed to bring your own food, which I didn't know. So these very nice Lebanese were feeding us sliced mango. And to be honest, I thought it tasted like I felt like I was eating goldfish. And that was a moment that I've never forgotten. So there's, you know it when it happens, one of those things.
Well, you do have a thing with fish. We'll get to that in a little while. What role do the people you're eating with play, Alan?
Well, as a critic, I always feel it's my job to tell the people what I think about the food. But on the other hand, I love to steal the opinions of other people who are eating with me. It doesn't, you know, I would prefer to give them credit, but I seldom do.
But there's that other factor. I've had wonderful food, but I've been at a table with somebody who just talked about himself incessantly.
You were with me.
And that really affected my response to the food.
Yes, it's important to be with people who are simpatico about food. I always get in trouble by saying I have a much better time eating with men than with women, because they seem to like to talk about food more than women do. Women like to talk about life. Doesn't that ruin the meal?
You think that's true?
The only thing that happens, I notice, and I go on a lot of these, you know, publishing lunches, is the women don't eat. You know, they'll order something and pick it around. So when I find somebody who is ordering dessert and not with 14 spoons, I'm really excited.
Well, so. Listen to the two of you and your stereotypes about women.
The next thing you got to say is that that a lot of women go to a really fancy restaurant and order the salad.
Yes.
Well, you know, that's
dressing
true.
On the side.
Well, Gilbert Lacoz, when he opened Le Bernardin, did not have a prefix menu. And he told me he switched immediately to a prefix because every woman who came in ordered the salad.
Now, I wonder if what happened earlier in the day matters. I mean, the mood that you're in when you're having these things. And could you be having the exact same meal elsewhere with different people and have a totally different experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I don't think it's an exaggeration for me to say, like, I think in one way or another, I have a kind of food epiphany every single day. I mean, surely there are others that stand out above other meals.
These are mini epiphanies?
They're mini epiphanies, yeah. I've heard about those. But I think that what for me is so fascinating about the telling of food memories is really they are the telling of us. They are the telling of who we are, the emotional context, the physical context of where we are eating that meal. It's so amazing. It's almost so amazing. It's like maybe it should be a part of some sort of like, you know, official therapeutic program, because it's so telling. It's like a true Rorschach test.
Well, in your introduction, you wrote about two particular times, one when you were quite young in a restaurant in Chicago, the sort of place you say doesn't exist all that much anymore. Was it unique to Chicago? What are we talking about?
A classic Chicago restaurant. Alan, you probably know the place, Jacques. One of those kind of old-time French restaurants that every great American city had back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. And then somewhere along the line in the 70s, these places went away. But to me, as a 12-year-old eating my first duck à l'orange, it was absolutely magical. It transformed me.
You said, in fact, that it was too magnificent for words. That's what you felt at the time? Did it help that you were with your father? Was he a good dining companion?
And really, I think, you know, to go back to this thing about the emotional context, sure, the duck à l'orange was amazing. Your mango, well, it sounds like it was sort of amazing, Lisa. But
I love mango now.
What was really special about that moment was the fact that, you know, in all honesty, my dad and I had a pretty fragmented relationship. And this particular moment brought us together. It sealed us.
Well, I'm wondering about that mango again, or the duck à l'orange, because as you say, Louisa, you had mango many times later.
Oh, my God, I love mango.
Yeah, well, but it never was as special, even if the mango you had the first time may not have been the best mango you ever ate.
No, well, it was like realizing that things can transform. I mean, here's something that was very odd. And I'm pretty adventurous with food. I've always been adventurous with food. But then mango, of course, is one of the most magnificent foods. But I remember as I grew up in this very small Italian community right down the street, actually, on Prince Street. And all we ate was Italian food, or the Italian food that Italian Americans ate. And there was
one. It could be pretty good.
It was wonderful. Mm. Red sauce. Mm. Red sauce. And there was one girl in the class who was Portuguese. And I went to her house and her mother made chorizo. And it was like, oh, my God, this is so great. So there's always been that interest in the other.
There is something about the otherness of food experiences that really can just get inside you so, so deeply, so profoundly, yeah?
Well, you also say another experience you had was on your first solo trip to Southeast Asia, where you've spent a lot of time since. It was street food?
Street food in Penang, Malaysia. I mean, to my mind, one of the world's not only great street food cities, but just great food cities. This place, if you haven't been there, it's a knockout. Get on the next plane there and just eat your way around it. It'll completely change your worldview. It did mine.
My guests are James Osland, Louisa Ermolino, and Alan Richman. We're talking about their food epiphanies that they have written about with a lot of other food lovers in a book called A Fork in the Road, Tales of Food, Pleasure, and Discovery on the Road. It's published by Lonely Planet. Alan, some would say that a foreigner going to Cairo less than a year after Arab Spring might be a bit foolhardy, especially if you weren't a normal journalist, but what you call a culinary anthropologist. What made you go there despite the warnings of your friends?
Well, this was an assignment from a magazine that the magazine ended up losing interest in. You know, there was an old saying in the army, many are called but few are chosen. You know, but so there I was, and I thought it was a great story, and I think the magazine didn't want it because it didn't express what they wanted it to say, that the food was great here. But I had some, you know, I did have some great dishes there. But the idea of just, this is old style journalism in the sense that, you know, you just we used to call it parachuting in. You're not prepared. You're not under a press trip. You're not under any kind of familiarity trip. You're not sponsored by anybody. You just land in the country, and you get out of your hotel and you start walking. And to me, there's nothing better than this in journalism. There's this idea of discovering. And so I had no qualms. I mean, Arab Spring had just about started then. It was underway. In fact, there was a big demonstration at Tahrir Square when I was there, which I went to, and I didn't feel threatened by anybody. And I just always feel that no one's ever going to harm me. That's how I feel when I drop into these places. Now,
I love the fact that you met a shopkeeper in Tahrir Square who was originally from Kew Gardens.
Yes, and he tried to tell me how much worse Kew Gardens was than Cairo, much more dangerous.
Well, why do you say that nothing is more transparent than in a restaurant?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I always think about going to Florence where everything is behind walls and you never get to see it. Mm-hmm. When you go into a restaurant, you can see the culture better than you can anywhere else when you go into a city where you don't know anybody. I mean, the restaurants are open. You can talk to everybody. You're exposed to whatever is taking place in front of you. It's quite public, but and people doing private things, eating dinner. And you can look into the kitchen. You can talk to the chef. It opens the doors to a city like I think nothing else does.
Well, Cairo is the capital city of Egypt.
Yes.
So is it similar to capital cities elsewhere where you not only have the local cuisine available but cuisines from other parts of the country and the world?
Well, it's similar in the sense that you do have those cuisines. It's dissimilar in the sense that they're not very good. I mean, the restaurants doing pizza, the restaurants doing Italian food, or the restaurants doing hamburgers, they were all unsuccessful as far as I was concerned. But you have them there, and it's fun to go. It's just as much fun to go into them as it would be to any other cities. The thing about Cairo is, I mean, this is my interpretation of Cairo, and I'm not an anthropologist in the sense of, I mean, it's a city that had its peak 100 years ago, and it looks it, and it feels it.
Now, was the Egyptian food markedly different from the Egyptian food that you can find in any number of restaurants in New York?
I think so, because I think the ones in New York are better.
It's usually the other way around.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but you know, there's a few Egyptian restaurants in Queens that I've been to that I thought were pretty good, so I've enjoyed them here.
Well, tell us about the kashari that you ate that meant so much to you in your story.
Yeah.
That you've given the title, Omar Sharif Slept Here.
That was pretty good title, by the way, James, if you did it.
It's one of the least expensive foods in the world.
Yes. You go into this restaurant, and it's a very ritualistic cuisine. There's no variations except by the idea of the restaurant. They may put in a chickpea instead of a lentil, or they may have less rice, or they have more rice. It's just a combination of a hodgepodge of local ingredients. And it was, I mean, it's one of these things where almost nothing adds up to a perfect dish. And you're talking about what is a great moment. It was an epiphany for me eating the kashari, and I don't have many epiphanies. I just am not an epiphany kind of guy. But it was so wonderful, and the place was wonderful, and the guy sitting, I mean, an Egyptian guy was sitting across from me and talked to me while I was eating.
Now, we'll get to your fish story in a little bit, Louisa, but I want to put a caller on. Susan from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for all of this wonderful, delicious talk. I am a woman. I am.
You're a woman? Susan,
I'm
so
in trouble already with the first caller.
And I love feeding. I am not obese, but I taste. And I think that's part of the whole thing of really tasting. My favorite meal, I think, I had in Maison Bleue in Fez.
Mm, wow.
And it was a combination of Andalusian, very ancient classic food. I think you know this, Leonard, the phyllo pastry, the pigeon and the egg dish that's classic to Moroccan food. This was like...
You're assuming that I've eaten in Morocco. I've never been to Morocco, but I do like phyllo pastry.
I mean, there are Moroccan restaurants here in New York, but nothing compared to this meal. And it was like... clouds, you know, great food that's tasty, that's light, you know, that combination. And it started with a whole variation of vegetables, and everything was perfectly done. And one last thing, my rule of thumb in going to a restaurant is after I taste the bread, which is put out in the very beginning. Sometimes I've walked out of the restaurant because the bread is so bad, and that's the indicator of what the meal is going to be like following.
Do you agree? That's been my experience. If the bread is good, usually the meal is going to turn out to be good as well. And if the bread is bad, that's an indication of what they think about food in general.
For me, it starts with the water. You know, the caller's statement sort of brings to mind for me, you know, there's something about, okay, life kind of goes on day in, day out. But the fact that we can experience a new taste and have our worlds open up and our understanding of our worlds open up in new ways. How fabulous is that, guys?
Well, we have to take a little break, and we'll think about how fabulous it is. My guests are James Osland, who's the editor and the author of the introduction for a book that is called Fork in the Road, Tales of Food, Pleasure, and Discovery on the Road, published by Lonely Planet. He is, in his other life, editor-in-chief of Savour and a judge also on Top Chef Masters. Louisa Amelino contributed a piece called Fish Heads to this book, and she's the reviews director of Publishers Weekly. And Alan Richman contributed Omar Sharif Slept Here. He's a longtime food writer. He's won 15 James Beard Journalism Awards for restaurant reviewing. Stay with us for more. We are back with Alan Richman, Louisa Amelino, and James Osland. We're talking about that thing, that epiphany, that food epiphany we will always remember. They have contributed to a book called A Fork in the Road. Other people who have also contributed to this book include Mata Jaffrey and Martin Yan, Michael Pollan, a wide range of food writers, one sort or another, or people in the food business. And we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org, on a Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Louisa, we got to tell your story. I held off on it a bit because some people might have their stomachs upset just a little bit by hearing your story. It's called Fish Heads, and it's definitely not about the sort of food I would expect that would make for an epiphany.
Well, it's always interesting because food is so tied to culture, and there's a discovery about food. You know, you eat something that you never even imagined that people eat. And I was in Indonesia, and I sort of got in this bizarre situation where I was on this ship that was supposed to be food included, which sounded great, until we got there, and the food was rice and fish heads.
Every day?
Every day. Twice a day. And everyone was really happy with it, except I had never seen these things. And, you know, it's a head. It's got eyes and it's got lips. And I never thought about it. And then I was very hungry. And when I started looking at this fish head and figuring it out, I found that there's some really tasty bits in a fish head. And probably the best part of a fish is under the cheek.
Yeah.
And there's
Asians
little
really prize fish cheeks.
Yes.
There's a story of a Vietnamese emperor who had 1,000 fish made for him, ate the cheeks, and then sent the rest off of the peasants to eat.
So it was this great discovery. And every day I discovered a little more. The meat near the top of the head, and there's kind of juice in the bones. And it was wonderful. So at the end of 7 days, I was really looking forward to my fish head dinner.
And then you landed, and you had a lot of different things available to you. Did you miss the fish heads?
No, not at all. I've never eaten them since, but I've never forgotten them either.
So you were in Singapore. Is there good
we
food
We arrived
in Singapore?
In Singapore. The food in Singapore was amazing. It was just a whole – I remember – it's a long time ago. I remember like the center of the city was just tents. And dining, you just went from one open restaurant to the other. It was endless. The food was really, really wonderful, very exotic.
A listener has written in. He said he remembers the first time he ate mango in London in the late 70s. They didn't have the sweet that he wanted, and when he was offered fresh mango instead, it was so perfectly ripe that it was a life-changing experience for him.
Mm-hmm. For me, by the way, the same thing was the World's Fair in New York eating pineapple.
Oh, real pineapple.
Your first pineapple?
First not out of a can.
It wasn't round with a hole in the middle in sugar syrup.
And stuck on a ham.
Faux apple.
Let's take another call. This is from April.
Hey, by the way, the same thing was the World's Fair in New York eating pineapple.
April, you're going to have to turn down your radio because we're on a little bit of a delay, and you're going to be very confused. April is from Larchmont. Hi, April. Are you there? Okay. Well, April, I'll put you on hold, and maybe my staff will be able to talk to you, and we'll put you on in a moment. Our next caller is Doug from New Jersey. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Hi, how you guys doing today?
Well, what was your food epiphany?
My food epiphany was when I was around, up until the point I was around 11 or 12, all I ate was fish sticks and hot dogs.
Sounds good.
Oh, yeah, let me tell you. And my parents one night said, this weekend we're going for our anniversary to a lovely restaurant in Manhattan. And we went to One If By Land. And we got there, and the waiter put the menus down, and I looked at it, and there was no fish sticks. I looked across the table at my father, and he said, don't worry, we're going to find you something. He looked at the menu, he said, you're going to try the beef Wellington. It's got bread on it like fish sticks. You'll love it. And I looked at him kind of suspiciously, and I said, okay, I'll try that. And came out and I looked at it and it doesn't look like a fish stick, but I'll give it a shot. And I tried it, and from that moment on, I was taken and absorbed with food. Just, I was willing to give it the chance, and that dish, the way it was prepared, the way it tasted, I could almost taste it now as I'm speaking to you. Just, I said, wow, there's really a whole other world out there besides fish sticks and hot dogs.
Now, I had a similar experience. I was a rather picky eater until I had no choice in the matter. First, I went to school in England, so I had to eat English food, but that even that was more adventurous than the food I was eating when I was growing up in Brooklyn. But at one point, I realized that I had to make a deal with myself, and I decided that I would eat anything that someone else at the table would eat. And that's led to me eating all sorts of weird things, including insects and other things. And I haven't regretted that deal I made with myself ever.
For me, life's too short to have, you know, extreme food dislikes, although I can respect other people for having theirs. I think when I was a kid, I didn't like grapefruits, tofu, or lima beans, and that was it. Everything else was free game.
I'm still with you for lima beans.
Oh, not me. I'll cook them for you sometime. Amazing food.
Okra.
Ugh. Oh, yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah, but in a gumbo, okra is great.
Yeah, for me it was cauliflower, but now cauliflower is getting really good.
People yes, and it comes in colors.
It used to reek. Now it's quite good.
But I know of a 7-year-old who just recently calls cauliflower white broccoli as a way of rejecting it. Let's go back to April. Hi, April.
Hi.
You're in Lochmont, right? Not
yes,
in Paris.
I am.
Okay.
Yes, my food epiphany was my first trip to Paris. This was back in the early 80s. And there was, I picked up some information from the New York Times about a new find on the left bank. And so we went down this, grungy little street where they had a street market into this little hole in the wall. And here I was in Paris, and the chef was Japanese, and I have a compulsion for trying new tastes, and so when I saw on the menu that he was preparing some meat with a raspberry wine blah 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 sauce, because it was like the very beginning of the nouvelle cuisine, I had to try it, and it was just amazing. I mean, it just opened up, you know, this whole world of utilizing fruits as part of your cuisine. My background is Chinese food, so I already have that adventure in me, and just the fact that I was, and I had friends who were on assignment through IBM in Paris, and it was such a joy, and they were living in Paris near the Parc Monceau. So for me, it was such an exciting experience to be able to, for me to come and be able to introduce them to a place that they didn't know about.
But I'm sorry. Finish?
No, I was just going to say, so that was my epiphany.
Now, Paris or France has been the epiphany place for an awful lot of people. Julia Child, of course, talked about not being interested in food until she went to France, and then we know what happened there.
You know they stole the cuisine from the Italians.
They stole a lot of it from the Italians. They told a lot of it from the Italians and that. From the Spanish, but you know what? They made it better.
They did. Okay.
And maybe still make it better. France is having real economic difficulties, but if I had enough euros, I'd go there right now and spend as much as I could on good meals.
I think we'll all tag along.
Let's take another call. This one is from Charis from Brooklyn. Hi, Charis.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I had a food epiphany in a funny place, and it was something pretty common. It was soft-shell crabs, which I'd never had before. This was maybe in the 90s in New York City. And I had them because someone had caught them from the water beneath the house on stilts that someone had drove me to in the dark. I didn't know where it was. It might have been near JFK. And they had soaked them all day. And these were strangers, a bunch of strange men. And me and my friend, we were in our 20s, we went there. They made us these soft-shell crabs. They were astounding, and that's when I learned in the 90s that you can get food in New York City, and it was wonderful to have this meal with these strangers, and we had a wonderful time.
Well, soft-shell crabs are something that a lot of people are squeamish about simply because of the thought, but they're usually cooked, drenched in butter. How can you go wrong?
Yeah, I was just going to say, a soft-shell crab should be an epiphanal food for a lot of people, because you know, the first time you eat that, it really is unlike almost any other food you've eaten.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how so many of these stories are about a new experience, an other, as you pointed out, Louisa, an adventure. But also epiphanies can come in the form of, I mean, for instance, this morning in my typical breakfast cereal, I eat muesli every single morning with a kind of like dogged ritual quality. But I went apple picking 2 weeks ago and I chopped up an apple that I put into this that was just so extraordinary, so delicious and sweet and crunchy.
But there's also the experience of having something better than you ever had before. Yeah. I never really appreciated wines when I was young because I usually had them at gallery openings and they were always quite awful. And then at a very nice meal, I had a really good wine. And suddenly I said, oh, that's what they're talking about.
Right. This is what
and I became
about.
Obsessed for a while.
Well, it's like vegetables. I mean, when they're fresh and wonderful, they're just so wonderful.
You got to try the okra, Louisa.
But yeah, the green texture. Markets have really probably led to a lot of epiphanies for people here, because sometimes you see something that you've never seen before. You ask the farmer, what is that and how do I prepare it? And the next thing you know, you're buying it every week.
Right.
Let's take another call. This one from Nancy from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I wanted to share an experience I had in, when I was traveling alone in my 30s, and I traveled to Florence and took a train to San Gimignano and found a little place to stay and walked through the piazza down to a little restaurant and ordered angel hair pasta with flakes of white truffle. Mm. And it came out, served to me, sitting alone at a table with a glass of white wine, and they shaved the truffle over the angel hair pasta for me. And if anybody's had white truffle, the scent just wafted up into my nose and just took me, transported me. And they served me a plate of room temperature prosciutto with the sweetest of orange melon. And I sat there, and as I tasted my food, I just was the happiest woman on the planet. I think I look like a Cheshire cat.
I suspect white truffles were a lot less expensive in those days than they are now.
Yeah,
because you have to be a millionaire to eat white truffles.
You could get that same meal here in New York for about $150.
I don't know. That description, I don't know about you guys. I'm done. I have to go eat now.
I know. Hey, by the way, you should be a food writer. You're a lot better than most of them.
Oh, that was exquisite. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Nancy. And we go now to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm well. You also had to leave the country to have this epiphanous experience?
Not, but my experience has had a lot to do with place as well. And I was doing an artist residency in Taipei, and I went to the night market, which is this, you know, odd, wonderful, surreal place where there are cages with live snakes and lizards against the walls, and you know, people ordering their food to be cooked right there, or even eaten live.
some of the videos would be of them cutting a snake and bleeding the snake into orange juice fermented drink for virility. I didn't go to that extreme, but I did have an amazing meal there of salt and pepper crab that had a broth with onion in it, which was just amazing. And the other experience was in Key West, Florida. The residency I was in had the residency studio of the Mango Treehouse, which had these incredible yellow mangoes, which were dropping every morning right on my porch. And there's nothing more I could do than hoard as many of them as I possibly could, and make you know, mango breakfasts and mango margaritas and anything else I could possibly.
You know, I'm wondering whether mangoes are in season right now, because listeners are all going to want to run out and get some mango.
Oh, and there's those special mangoes without the strings.
Ones that are coming from India, the Alfonsos that are like custard. They are so delicious.
We have time to sneak one more caller in. This is Michael from Leonia. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Yes. I can remember having pizza in Fox Chase, Pennsylvania, when I was about 8. And this is sort of a reverse epiphany in that I've been always searching for this pizza for the rest of my life, and I've always been disappointed.
Michael, is this my Michael from Leonia?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'll find you that pizza one of these days.
There's some pretty good pizzas today.
But my real epiphany was having truffles on scrambled eggs in a truck stop in upstate New York.
But I wonder about pizza. Maybe it's just the first time you have something that becomes the standard by which you judge everything that follows. But right now, New York is probably one of the greatest places to get pizza in the world, don't you think?
Yeah.
I agree with that.
By the way, what Michael was talking about, I was doing a story, and we three of us drove up to Montreal for a dinner, and we carried truffles with us, and we stopped at a truck stop up there, and we ordered lunch, and we said, do you mind if we put our truffles over everything at lunch?
I love it.
And it was so wonderful. People were out of their minds. They didn't understand the smell. They didn't understand any of it, but people were so startled and so delighted by the whole thing.
I love it. It was great. How sweet.
Thank you all so much for being on our show. Alan Richman contributed a piece called Omar Sharif Slept Here to the book we've been discussing, A Fork in the Road, Tales of Food, Pleasure, and Discovery on the Road, which is published by Lonely Planet. Luisa Ermolino, her piece was called Fish Heads. And James Oslin is the editor, and he wrote the introduction for this book and also, I guess, asked a lot of friends to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great fun.
That was a blast.